All right, thank you very much, and thanks to everyone listening to us. I've got amazing panelists. My name is Razak Adekoya. I work with Site Savers as a global technical advisor for economic empowerment. And I think we'll be talking around global innovation and technology, the effect and the impact on persons with cyclers. How do we collaborate? How do we learn? And how do we exchange this knowledge and facilitate it, particularly for people in the global south? But before we start, let's start with a bit of introduction with the panelists. Let me start with Rob from Scare.
Rob.
Good, and I'm sure we have other panelists. Linda Rogers from RNIB. Thank you. It'd be good to have Molemisi from Visual Aid Africa, and Sabrina, both from the same organization. Thank you. And also, it'd be good to have Dan from the Canadian CNIB. All right. So maybe I'll allow each of the panelists to probably just do a bit of introduction for 1 minute. So let me probably start with Linda.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Matt introduced me this morning, but I will say I'm here as the Chief Technology Officer for RNIB, and I've been in the role for about 3 to 4 months now, and I think it's really showing a testament to RNIB's commitment to technology being an enabler for people with sight loss. So the fact that I'm here is actually showing that we are very committed to this course. We know that technology is going to enable, and obviously we're going to be discussing how technology is evolving really quickly and how do we ensure that we're getting all of the benefits for our and adding value for blind and partially sighted people. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Just let me also move to Rob from Skia.
Okay, good morning, everybody. I'm Robert, and I work for the Scottish Catholic International Aid Fund, where I'm a program manager. Our programs are based mainly in Africa, countries like Zambia, Malawi, Democratic Republic of Congo, etc. And we do what we call international development, but obviously we try to do inclusive international development, where we ensure that everybody in communities, etc., gets to participate and gets to fulfill their potential. So, and within that as well, we also do projects which are exclusively directed at people with disabilities, a variety of those. So it's really great to be here this morning. I've already heard a lot of things that really sparked ideas and want to speak to a few people. So I'm looking forward to this discussion and hearing more, and hopefully providing some information about the work we do and the context in which we work and how it is quite challenging.
Thank you very much for that. Let me move to Diane.
Hi, thanks everyone. I'm Diane Bergeron, and as was mentioned, I'm from CNIB, which is the Canadian National Institute for the Blind. I'm based out of Ottawa in Canada. CNIB provides programs and services for people who are blind, partially sighted. We also have our sister organizations, which is Vision Loss Rehabilitation Canada, and also Deafblind Community Services within Canada. So we've integrated a lot of programming, everything from rehabilitation from VLR to intervener services under Deafblind Community Services. And then CNIB is very involved in advocacy, various programming. We do a lot of public relations, government affairs, and so on and so forth, and some leisure activities. But one of our key areas that I'm involved in is around international development, international programs. And I've been at the CNIB, I've been there just about 13 years. And for 12 of those years, I've been connected to the World Blind Union. You heard from Mark Rickman yesterday, the CEO of the World Blind Union. And in fact, CNIB was one of the founding members of the World Blind Union. So we have been involved in international work since 1930, I believe, was the first time we started involving ourselves. I haven't been there that long, but that's when they started. And just in December, I had been working in our guide dog program and doing international work as I said, sort of off the side of my desk for 12 years. And in December, I was asked to develop a whole new department on international partnerships so that CNIB can be more connected to the international space and look at global issues. So that's where we're at.
That's amazing. I'm sure we'll talk much about that pretty soon. But let me quickly move to Mulemisi.
Hello, everybody. Good morning. My name is Mulemisi Konon. I'm from Visualize Africa International, which is my company, to say. I'm a habilitation specialist, as well as a vision rehabilitation. I work on a daily basis, you know. But our company is looking at, which we will share in a minute or so, what we may take or for granted in here in terms of, early interventions for children born with vision impairment, especially in the continent of Africa. I'm from Botswana. However, we also, when we started as Africa, in just Africa, but we realized that the Caribbeans, where we have been a couple of times, is also an issue that Africa faces. So these are the things that we're doing in the continent, both especially in Africa. We just came back from Uganda not too long ago. We work with our partners in there. I don't know if that's why I was talking about Zambia or Kenya yesterday and all that. We are very familiar with those East African countries. You know, we work with our partners from iHealth, with the doctors. We go there, especially to Uganda, with a lot of doctors from Morphils, you know. And we work locally with a hospital there, Malago Hospitals, Homa Hospital, and so many others, and deafblind schools. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we'll talk much about the work you do. Let's go to Sabrina, which is,
Hi, I'm Sabrina Jazul, and my day job is I'm a qualified teacher for children and young people with vision impairment. I'm also a qualified teacher of the deaf, and I'm based in London, and I deploy a team of specialist teachers and habilitations specialists to, build capacity locally, obviously with the students I support, but also build capacity in schools, education settings, and even in my local area, ensuring we create an inclusive environment for our residents. But it's a big job, but I still have time to volunteer for Visionize Africa International. I'm really passionate about that, obviously because of my African origins, but also there's a lot of children in London who happen to come from Africa. And sometimes when they land in my local area, that's when we realize that they didn't really quite have access to education the way we actually are already working on it here on this side of the globe. And that's why I wanted to do a bit more work locally, starting with people in their local context, and see what is it that we, with our collective knowledge from the global north, we could actually bring, what kind of value we could bring to the global south, and see how we can move that agenda for them and widening the access to the world, basically.
Amazing. Thank you very much for that. I'm sure you now met all the panelists. But before we go, probably it would be good for us to play this very short audio from Skia.
South Sudan is one of the world's poorest countries. It has very few resources, and so it has very little in terms of money to spend on anyone, let alone someone with disability.
This is Stephen Martin, a disability specialist working for the Scottish Catholic International Aid Fund, otherwise known as SCIAF.
So those who are born with a disability are really at the bottom of the pile. It's tough. It's totally tough.
For the majority of people living in South Sudan, AI, apps and audio glasses are another world away. So when I was asked to make a piece about the role of technology in supporting people in the world's poorest places, I wasn't sure where to begin.
Life in South Sudan is very hard for people with disabilities.
I'd been put in touch with Alfred, who was one of the people SCIAF supports in South Sudan. He is also blind.
It's really hard for people with disabilities to find work so that we can help ourselves.
I then asked him how technology might be able to help.
If we are taught how to use Braille, our lives in South Sudan could really change.
Rebecca, one of SKIAF's local partners, continued.
Braille opens a door for education and social interaction for visually impaired persons and communities, and provides a permanent opportunity for people in South Sudan.
Braille has been around for more than 200 years. Fortunately, it's something SKIAF has been able to provide to a number of communities in South Sudan, thanks to funding by the UK government. But would we really consider Braille a technological solution to support people with disabilities? Not really. But in South Sudan, this old technology is clearly making a difference. So, what about AI, apps and audio glasses then? I asked Stephen if these modern technologies would have a role to play in his work in the future.
Technology that we have is amazing, but I think within a South Sudan context, they don't have access to anything like the same technology. I mean, almost every one of us has a smartphone that can do multiple tasks. I'm yet to see a smartphone. They don't have internet. If you're lucky enough to live in a place where you could access internet, it's prohibitively expensive. Any internet-based technology that would help is just inaccessible.
Like Alfred, Veda has also been supported by SKIAF in South Sudan.
It started with a headache one day. My leg was hurting and I was taken to the clinic. That's when my leg started to go numb.
Veda was just 16 at the time. There was no proper medication available for her. She was paralysed, couldn't walk, and could only sit in one spot until someone helped her move on.
SKIAF came to help me and took me through different exercises until I began to regain feeling in my legs.
In addition to the exercises, Veda received life-changing equipment, including crutches and a tricycle that she uses to move around her village. She thought she would never walk again, but today Veda can now even take steps unaided. Okay, so could you just tell me your name and your role at SKIAF?
My name is Kira Commons and I'm the contract manager for the Climate Just Communities program in Rwanda. I guess the way we view disabilities is the disability is an impairment, and the impairment is not an issue unless the environment is not conducive to it. So if the environment was fully accessible, the impairment wouldn't necessarily be a barrier. So in the places we work with, particularly in Rwanda, the environment is a big issue. This terrain is incredibly steep. So it's really steep terrain. The roads are often on surface so that they can be quite bumpy. The communities you work with have experienced a lot of flooding and landslides. So there's been a lot of damage to their houses. So if you have a disability, particularly say like a physical disability, just even moving around the place is really difficult. I think low-tech solutions are so important and they can really change a person's life. So basic things like having access to a white cane if you've got a visual impairment, also access to a wheelchair that has quite robust wheels because the terrain is quite tricky, and even things like having walking frames.
A picture is emerging that yes, technology has a role to play in supporting people with disabilities in low-income settings. But forget AI. Older technologies like providing Braille, providing prescription glasses or wheelchairs are likely to be much more impactful in these places. And of course, technology alone will never be the complete solution to any global challenge. I'll leave the final word to Kira.
I think what's important, I think how SCIAF works is this community-based approach. And I think that's really important for finding people that are marginalized, because people that have disabilities can often be hidden away and stigmatized. You really need to have a good partnership approach in your program to actually even just reach the people and build their relationship and build a trust with them. So then you can work with them holistically. So I think sometimes when we approach these things, we don't recognize that people that have disabilities are often so marginalized, you may not even know that they are there, or they may be quite hidden. And that's an important barrier to break down in the first step.
So thank you very much for that video, Skye. And I think probably it would be good to start with Rob, particularly looking at the work you're doing across Africa. What are the lessons you're learning from those work? Because the conversations around global innovation, global collaboration, what have you learned in implementing some of those programs in Africa?
Okay, well, thank you very much. Well, I'd like to kind of build a bit on what was talked about in the video. So that the whole, SCIAF, we work very much in those resource poor environments and very specifically in rural environments. So I literally came back last week from Malawi, and if anyone's been to Malawi, you know that the road infrastructure there is quite challenging, shall we say. As soon as you leave the main roads, you're off to many dozens and dozens of rural communities who are it's mud tracks, as described in the talk just there. They're very difficult for people to move around on, whether even in a 4x4, let alone somebody who has some kind of physical disability, etc. And in the context of working as well, is about the impact of climate change. You know, it may seem suddenly quite removed, but in fact it's very central. So you've got countries like Malawi, which has suffered constant extreme flooding over the last 10 years or so, which basically creates an even more dangerous and difficult environment for everybody, but especially more so if you're somebody who has some kind of physical or visual impairment, for example. So these kind of challenges, they compound. And so also like things like a lack of electricity. There are inroads being made with solar panels, and that is something we've seen over the last 10 years or so, as the prices drop in that area. They do become more accessible. They are starting to be more common. But again, they're still quite exclusive, so the better off members of the community might have access to them. And they're being used in a relatively limited way. They're usually used for charging mobile phones. So I know my colleague Stephen was talking about mobile phones in South Sudan, that he doesn't see smartphones. Well, it's true there, because South Sudan is one of the poorest, if not the poorest country in the world. But in other countries we work in, such as Malawi or Zambia, there is much greater penetration of the mobile phone network and data services and so on. So I think there are great potentials there, which are beginning to be used. But it's very early days in terms of them being used to specifically support people with either visual or physical disabilities. So that's the kind of context we're in. And so I suppose the question really becomes, what's the kind of low tech or high tech? And really our experience is it's much more that low tech. A lot of the time it's about maintenance. How do you repair something? If you introduce something that's high tech, how on earth do you maintain that when it goes wrong? Which inevitably, it will go wrong at some point in the same way low tech does. So, for example, in South Sudan, we set up a workshop where basically devices were made for local people to use, so such as tricycles, so you could build them there. But even the challenge there in that context, because it's so extreme, is actually the parts. They all have to come in from neighboring countries. So you've got these layers of expense that are added and create real, real challenges. So even maintaining low tech can be quite tricky. People, can they afford to have a tire replaced or a wheel if it's damaged on a wheelchair, etc.? You really have to take these kind of things into consideration and try and support that infrastructure behind these innovations. So again, I would say at this point, hopefully in the future, greater tech, technology more advanced will come online, and it will eventually. Who knows when? At this moment, I think our lesson is that people need that support now, and they can't afford to wait. So I think that's something I would really emphasise there. And the other aspect that was touched on is about that integrated and holistic approach. So we work always with disabled people's organisations. You know, it's all about local people doing things for themselves. And where can we come in and where can we support and provide that extra impetus and boost? Very often it's money, sometimes it's capacity training, other times it's linkages, sometimes it's around advocacy strategies. Because so much, very often you find that, you know, there are laws, there are services in place, but they're simply not utilized. People don't know about them. People haven't got the skills to provide them effectively. People aren't identified who actually need those services. So very often it's about supporting those disabled people's organizations, but also recognizing that they're part of the community. So how do you work with community leadership? How do you work with what other providers might be and other services might already be in a community and bring them together? So it's doing that and also supporting the families. So much rehabilitation and support is obviously within the family context, in the household. So in South Sudan, for example, there are children with cerebral palsy and they often need physiotherapy. So we've trained a lot of, we've had outreach workers who go out and they train the family members to be able to actually provide that in the home setting. So there's a kind of that integrated and holistic approach where you take a whole community and society view rather than an individualistic view, although obviously you do look at that individualistic individual as, you know, the important center of the support.
That's a lot of work you're doing there, Rob, particularly, I mean, like when you talk about the issues of high tech and low tech, I could probably, I mean, easily relate because I work across many of the countries in Africa and I know part of the issues around the tech is that more often we develop high tech, forgetting that there are still people in the low region. And we know 80% of people with disabilities are living in developing countries. But let me come to Dan, particularly around this global situation for people with sight loss. Are we getting it right? Are we progressing?
It's an interesting question. If we had it right, we wouldn't be here. And many of us would be out of work, which might be an awesome thing. But I think I can say that we're getting it better, but more so better for the, you know, approximately 20% of blind and partially sighted people who live in developed countries. But for the other 80% in the global south and in developing countries, the technology, though fascinating, is not necessarily helpful when what, you know, you take these devices and you go, we get these great devices. And I was thinking about a friend of mine who went to a hospital in I believe it was Burundi and brought all this, you know, iPads and all sorts of different things for the hospital to use, thinking she was doing this wonderful thing. And she said, what else could you use? And they said, well, stable electricity would be good. And then she said, well, what good is this iPad when they don't have electricity and they don't have, you know, internet access? And then, you know, it's suddenly goes to a completely different level. So I think that from a perspective of technology, I think that we're doing a good job in the fact that we're now going towards, as Gus was saying, we're not doing the as much of the specific devices as we are doing more mainstream, which I think is amazing, provided that the companies continue to incorporate changes when they're making changes. It drives me absolutely off my rocker when I have an app that is so wonderful and then they do an update to it and suddenly all the accessibility features are gone and I can't use it anymore. So yeah, tech companies, please don't do that. but I think the key factor is also around, you know, like I said, electricity and some of those internet access and training, teaching people. CNIB, along with RNIB and a few others, started with the Orbit Reader Project. And I was so proud to go to Rwanda taking a bunch of Orbit Readers to a school for the blind. And I got there and with these wonderful devices and then kind of went, oh, no, we don't have any. We're not teaching the teachers to teach the students how to use these. So then we had to go back in our thinking because in my mind, they were pretty intuitive. But they were intuitive from a Canadian developed country concept. They were not intuitive from the perspective of a school in rural Rwanda, where they didn't have a lot of the access to things. So it was a big change for me in how I was thinking. So we're getting it better, but I think that we need to remember that as we get it better, we have a responsibility not just to serve a certain level of the population or a certain part of the population, but we also need to look at our technology from a perspective of how are we going to use this technology all around the world and provide that support to the Global South in training and access through funding options, and also through the understanding that maybe what's first needed is a little bit of capacity building in access to internet and electricity.
Amazing there. And really, I mean, if you look at the issues around the Global South, access, ability for people to use this technology, and you start wondering, is it a factor of lack of capacity or lack of awareness? But maybe that would take me much better to Linda, who is the CTO for RNIB, looking at the fact around, I mean, many charity organizations in developing countries like yours here have a lot of resources. But how do we take those resources and network and using it to create ally to increase equity for people who are much more in the developing countries?
Thank you, Rasak. So RNIB is UK focused, but we definitely have a global outlook. And I think we see this as a great, tremendous opportunity for us to help bridge the equity gap. So I'll first of all say I covered West Africa and Eastern Central Africa in one of my jobs a long time ago. And it was quite interesting that when I landed from the UK with all of the bright ideas for technology, because I'm a technologist, and the issue we had was last mile. Literally the last mile in regards to someone has dug up, they're drilling the roads and they've dug up the whole last mile and the whole office was down. And so it brings to light that conversation around, yes, we're designing for all, but really are we taking into consideration for the areas? So for me, it's basically how do we think globally, but then be able to act local, basically. I had on my tagline for a long time, think global, act local, basically. So if we're truly going to design for inclusivity and for sustainability, then the conversation that we as RNIB see is how do we use our influence, use our networks to sort of like support technology in the Global South. So from my perspective, I think there's certain strategies that we should be using. And one of those is basically, and one of the ladies actually said something that was quite, one of the ladies from the University of Glasgow said something that was really that sort of like hit and I want to sort of like bring to light here. She said, the tech companies should design for the end user, not for the organization. Right, that I wrote that down really quickly, because if we are designing for the end user, and let me use the Global South as or developing countries as the end user in its perspective, then we're sort of like designing and giving open source. So that actually you design something, but it's open source, so that in the localization, they can actually develop it to fit the area that it needs to be used. I agree with the low tech piece, so it's definitely not high tech. We're talking about AI. Some countries in the developing, so I'm originally from Nigeria. I've covered Uganda, I've covered Eastern Central Africa and Kenya. But in Nigeria, we can do AI, but it's going to be low tech. So how do we influence our third parties, our partners, likes of Google, the likes of Meta, the likes of Microsoft, to design but also provide open source so that locally they can sort of like use the open source to sort of like design it for the local environment. So I think that's definitely one place that we should be influencing. So Meta, Google, Microsoft, we need to talk. I think another thing we need to do also is also advocacy and education. So we need to ensure that we are actually knowledge sharing. So what we've seen work really well, what hasn't worked well, how will it actually be used in the area that the local area that we need it to be used. So it's also partnership and working with the local South to sort of like use this technology. So I know we've been talking about, you know, it's electricity and all of that, but I'm a technologist, so I believe that we still have the ability to bring tech to the Global South, low tech be it, but we also have to educate and see how that will actually land. So there's a bit of context here in regards to design. So while we're designing for everyone and we're designing for sustainability, we also need to bring the word context into the design space. Thanks.
But before you leave there, you talk around knowledge sharing, yeah, and particularly if we don't want to leave no one behind. I mean, organizations like yours and other organizations, how are you taking those knowledge sharing with smaller organizations in developing countries?
I think I'm 3 months in my role, and Razak, I know me and you were talking yesterday already. I was like, we need to talk. So I think definitely that's the conversation. We need to start to talk about hackathons. We need to start to talk about bringing communities together. I remember myself and the CIO from Guide Dogs, we were talking about yesterday, and Razak, I told you we're looking for you, weren't we, to sort of like talk about this. How do we bring these communities together, start to have the discourse? It's about the discourse and about how we need to sort of like support. We also said yesterday that, you know, design with us, not for us. So basically, it's a conversation that needs to happen in regards to, we're not thinking that we know the answer, but actually having that conversation in regards to how do we share knowledge? What should we be doing? And sort of like then moving forward with that. So watch this space.
Okay, let's watch out. But let me quickly go to Mulamise, particularly around rehabilitation. I mean, that's a very gray area that a lot of people aren't looking at. I mean, I lost my sight a bit around when I was much more around a bit as an adult. What are the challenges you're facing when it comes to rehabilitation? And how do you think the global community can support this conversation, particularly both for Global South and, I mean, people in developed countries?
Thank you very, very much for that question. As a rehabilitation specialist myself, we know what we can, with Sabrina here, we know what we can enable a child to do, you know. So the challenges that we find in the continent, not just in the continent, in the Caribbeans, we just came back from there very recently. So it's all fresh in ourselves, is that at the diagnostic, when a child has been lucky enough to be diagnosed with sight loss or low vision or whatever it could be, is that there isn't any form of a referral system, you know. So especially if you are from Kampala or from, you know, these other cities, you may be lucky enough that you could be referred somewhere, you know. But if you come from the very rural, which where we are, you know, where we work along a lot with people, you are literally, you just disappear. Mm-hmm. So that's a very, very big challenge. But also that the children, especially, you know, they don't have, even if, let's say, you do manage to refer somewhere, And we want to be cautious to lump things, you know, when I'm talking about habilitation specialist here. But what I'm also is that the children don't get to be trained preschool. And this is very, very serious problem or serious challenge because a lot of these countries, they don't have this habilitation specialist. So these young children, they don't have, nobody is giving them a look to train them in anything, you know, to tie your shoes, to where's my left, where's my right, what's concept development, you know, mannerism, all sorts of things. So what do you find in the schools that we work with, or the people that we come, you know, we're encountering, is that when they start school, you know, they have no basic of anything. What it means like QTVIs, as Sabrina was, you know, referring to herself as a QTVI, is that instead of starting to teach the children the curriculum, RNIB did curriculum like probably 2 or 3 years ago, which they are not there already to start with, is that they start now teaching the children habilitation, you know. So, and we must also remember the children now come at early age, they're already beyond when they should have started. So they start teaching them how to tie their shoes. They start to teach them how to brush their hairs, you know, and the age difference as well. They're studying most of the schools, sometimes multi, you know, schools. They're already older than their peers. And this creates a lot of problem. Resentment for the individuals. Why am I in the class with these young people? Or I'm so old. So this is a very, very big challenges. And of course, technology. I'm not going to speak about technology, but there's an issue of technology. I might just say, you were talking about law tech there. Thank you very much, RNIB. Last year, you gave us, probably I said this yesterday, you gave us a brand new Braille, and we donated. We passed it on to the school, the Deafblind School, and we just came back this year in February, and it made a huge difference, you know. You were asking, what can we do here? Well,
yeah. What can the global community do to support?
Yes. You know, one of the things that we have started developing with universities there is a diploma course. It's at the early stage, which we'll call you upon you to be with us. So we're starting developing a diploma course that will train kind of habilitation specialists to send them to rural villages, you know, to make this early training of children. So please come with us. This is new. We're studying it. It's already on. We have dug the foundation, you know. So come with us on this platform. But also, we again with locals, it's better, as it has been said so many times, that we don't come and impose what we think, mm-hmm. what we think here works. Well, it works here, but we are totally different environment. So it's advocacy, especially in rural villages, to, you know, politicians and all this, but to, there's also stigma here also. We can't forget that being disabled or vision impaired. We're starting to build this advocacy to say, look, it shouldn't be this way, you know. And we're speaking about people who are doing the job on the ground here, that any child is as good as any child and is capable, with support, of course, as any other child. So these are the things that we are currently doing, and we would like you to really, you know, let's hold hands together. And these projects are studying them right now. So this is a very right time to get on the platform. And of course, technology, we would like this open source that has been said. You know, technology can be, I mean, we are already talking about AI. You know, when is it gonna, you know, we will talk about law tech. Things are already flying over our heads. Probably by the time we get to the technology, we'll be in another AI or something. You know what I mean? So this is probably of many things that we can, or here can help, you know. And please, I'm here, we are here. So let's have a conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think it's quite important. I can relate particularly on this issue of rehabilitation, where you have children young adults with disabilities who are just leaving primary school, probably at age 15. I mean, before they even go into secondary school, go into university. And today, many of the programs, you see young people's programs are designed for age 15 to 24, right? And then the question is, how do you expect that young person with disability who had delay, I think the best word to use there is waithood, to be able to benefit from some of this program. So I could definitely relate with you there. But let me quickly come back to Diane before I go back to Sabrina. Assistive devices seems to be a bone of concern for many people in developing countries. The costs is quite prohibitive, expensive. I mean, Dr. Webb talked about it yesterday. What can we do to reduce this? I think I know there's this option around the economy of scale, but what do we need to do, and how do you think we can start working together to look around this, particularly to in making assistive devices and technology more affordable?
So, first of all, I think everybody should go to the Global South and get the experience. Mm-hmm. When I went to the school in Rwanda, I came back and I had to do a presentation to our national board, and I was asked, what was the big sort of aha moment for you? And it was the only thing that separates me from the children in that school is geography. I was born in the right place at the right time, and therefore I have all of these privileges. And it was so profound for me that all I can think about with that is how do we make sure that we can help provide an opportunity so that geography is not an issue. You can be born anywhere in the world and have the same access to all of these things. And right now, I've been walking around tapping my credit card. I don't even have to put in a PIN number anymore. I just wave it in the right direction and things get paid for. I wish somebody paid my bill, but still. But that means I have access to banking, to finance, to now I can have credit. Now I can get a mortgage. Now I can get a job. Like, there's all these things that connect to all of this. And they don't have that in a lot of ways. So there's a few things that I was thinking of. First of all, the student, and Linda brought it up, the student that mentioned companies should be designing for the people, not to the benefit of the company. And if that student does not have a job by the end of the day, I'll be shocked. And I think that that's a very big thing. I was thinking about how we could come up with a challenge for the technology companies that are here. And I was thinking, if we added $1 to every single technological device, program, or service that you provide, and take all of that money, in this room alone, you'd have a lot of money. And you take all that money and put it into one single pot that then gets used to the benefit of the Global South, as opposed to designing only for 20% of the population. We use that money to help, and then we work together as businesses to think about the benefit of those individuals. That might help us to then look at the local, to take the ability to go into local communities and find out what their needs are. And then we've got some money to help them in that area. Because right now, when you were talking about scale, yes, it's scale. But the scale is because we're looking at it from a charitable model. Mm-hmm. We're going to fix this problem for these people in this small little pot of money. Well, this is a world problem. This isn't a problem in this room. This is not a problem for blind people or people with disabilities. This is a problem that we all share. And if every person that bought an iPhone or an Android device or Meta glasses paid $1 more, then the rest of the world could be saved, in my opinion. That's a challenge for everybody.
Interesting. What a challenge there. I'm sure we'll get more questions particularly. But let's go to Sabrina. Looking at children, you work with children with disabilities.
That's right.
How is this technology working? What are the form of technology really working? And how have you seen this technology aiding and supporting their learning capabilities?
Well, to start with, I'm going to reiterate what the colleagues on this panel said. It's very important to set up the context before we even start talking technology. Let's not forget technology, it's a mean to an end, not an end in itself. So we can't just parachute some kind of AI or robots into a local context, hoping that it's going to get adopted. Technology has to bring, in a way, instant value added to the user if it's going to be used. And I think that's, first of all, my first main challenge as a teacher of children with vision impairment. If the benefit doesn't outweigh the inconvenience, you can forget that technology. That technology is already dead before it even got touched. So that's the first thing. So basically, obviously, on this panel, we talked about the economic barriers. So yes, some of these technologies, they're not even going to reach the airport, border before people can get their hand on it. The high cost, they've got limited funding in Africa and in the global south, the lack of local repair, like let's say just Perkins Brailler. This is not necessarily high tech. But if something goes wrong with one of the touches, how do you get it repaired? You have to actually contact companies in the UK or in America. That's a kind of mounting the costs. So already we see here the disadvantages. We also have issues, like you said, Rob, in terms of infrastructure. Infrastructures, if it's something that uses electricity and internet, how viable is it within the whole country, basically? We also have that rural and urban kind of divide. So sometimes we talk about governance and policies, and obviously at government level, we want to think about the whole country. But how do you do that when urban hubs have access to infrastructures that, villages in remote places don't actually... And these are the people I want to reach. These young children that I don't know of, I want them to be referred, but we don't know where they are. We can't find them. So I think maybe, working with the local health systems and finding ways, using technology, leveraging technology to ensure we can find these children, young people who need our help, would be amazing, I think. So talking about how we use technology, then, first of all, you've got to look at technology through the prism of the local communities. And you've got to take the individual as they are with their, vision. How do they access the visual world? And then evaluate this against the environment they actually evolving in. And to be honest, the job is very similar in London. When I go into schools, I have to look at the child as a whole, but I also have to look at the environment in which they evolve and identify the barriers, look at the needs, look at the barriers, and then come up with solutions which are sustainable. And yes, you're right, Rob, some of these solutions, especially in the global south, they're low tech. But even in London, some of these solutions are low tech sometimes. Yeah. We don't have to go high tech to actually find something tangible that's going to enhance somebody's quality of life on a day-to-day basis, basically, or access to information, development, education. So yes, sometimes we don't have to go really super high tech, although I love technology. I think I was 10 years old when I thought about robots and artificial intelligence. It's already here. It's quite amazing, but we still have a long way to go to sort of embed it in the global south, if that makes sense. So I think, obviously, Android devices are great tools just because they're affordable. They're more affordable. In London, I tend to advocate for Apple's a bit more, Apple devices, because of all the amazing inbuilt sort of universal design suit they offer. But in the global south, Android device, because of the open source nature, so you can actually tailor the device to local context. So the local developers can actually, adapt the phone with apps would make them relevant to local context. So that's, and also they're kind of affordable, and locally they're better supported with, manufacturers who can help if it goes wrong, etc. They've got, pre-installed services, which are very valuable over there, like Google Map, but also Google Translate. And we were delighted, 3 years ago, when Google Translate added 10 languages, African language, one of them being Lingala from the DRC, Bambara from Mali, and even Twi from Ghana. That's amazing. These are all a great addition. Obviously, we still the AI still need to learn the machine. It's not actually very accurate, but it's a step in the right direction. It's amazing, and it's giving us lots of hope, and it's giving visibility to these people living in these countries. Yes, because up to now they didn't really have visibility, which was sad. They had to function maybe in English or in French, languages which are not necessarily their mother tongue.
So, okay. I can imagine. Sabrina is quite passionate about this conversation.
Sorry about it. I took too long.
But I know if I take it longer, we'll continue. But I think what we can hear, it's around the fact that technology could work, but we need to understand the context and we need to think about adapt. But let's take some question. I will just take only two questions because of time. But and then I will wrap up this conversation. So maybe we just take two questions.
Hi, lovely panel. Really nice to hear about everything that you said. So I'm a UX researcher, so I do a lot of research. And I was just interested if you guys do a lot of research when conducting or implementing technologies in certain contexts. So yeah, that's my question.
Okay, we'll take just the last question so we can then respond together.
Thank you very much. My name is Gabriel Rotimi Aroge, mobility assistant to Razak. I actually studied entrepreneurship and innovation from the University of Sussex. I'm privileged to be here. And I actually asked this question yesterday. I asked him and he said he will be moderating this session. Probably I could talk about it. In the Global South, or Africa, or developing world, where I come from, and I lived there for 50 years before I came around, people who are disabled, the only thing they know about entrepreneurship is to use the disability to beg on the streets. And people take advantage of that, they abuse them, and then you use them differently. But in this part of the world, what I've seen here, I just changed my perspective about so many more things that can be done to enterprise the world around disability. Look at the robot dog, look at the lenses, the glasses, the equipment that we are put out there. These are all commercial innovations and inventions that if introduced to the Global South and then they are empowered, the landscape will change. So I actually wanted to know if we are looking in the area of enterprising that space, especially for the Global South, where there is a lot of gaps, a lot of knowledge gap, financial gap, inclusion is really, really so wide there. So that's exactly what I wanted to find out. What is the level of enterprise development around the PWD in the Global South?
Thank you very much. Just to wrap up this conversation, I'll allow each of the panelists just to do one minute, particularly just to wrap up their thoughts. I'm going to start with you, Sabrina. 1 minute, if you have any response to the questions or to wrap up your thoughts.
I mean, there's a lot of innovation in Africa. People have to function and they find solutions and very creative in Africa. But I think what we need now is partnership and mentorship. And we need to, together, Global North, Global South, join ourselves as a global community and increase our social capital. I mean, I just want to put a thought to you. It's nice to have technology like AI and robots and so on, but what happens when you don't have Wi-Fi and you've run out of battery? Suddenly, you'll have to fall back onto the solutions that Africa is looking for at the moment anyway. So it's good that we work together.
Thank you. I'll move to Rob. 1 minute.
Okay. On entrepreneurship, one example I'd give is that we don't set up kind of parallel institutions for people with and without disabilities. It's about integration. So we have lots of savings and loans groups within communities. And within that, you'll find all members of the community. So including people with disabilities, people with albinism, people with vision impairment and so on. So it's very important to make sure that, you know, that's part of the cohesive community building, integration, acceptance kind of process that we follow. And within that, people can access funding and people then take loans and they set up businesses, etc., that have been, you know, successful in their communities and learn new skills and so on.
Thank you. That is, we don't need to ghost the system. Mainstreaming is important. Let's go to Molemise.
Well, as I said, come with us. Let's change not just the kind of improve the quality of life for the individual, but it's a societal thing. We need to also talk to the politicians and, you know, all this is we are all in it together. We cannot just leave it for that's what I was talking about, the eye health. We recognize that this referral system, it doesn't happen. So it means children are out. You know, some of the people have to go literally door to door and ask, where are the children? Where are the blind children? You know, or they've had somebody say, oh, there's a blind child somewhere. You know what I mean? So we need seamless referral systems. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll come to you, Dan. Probably you have any response to that research question?
So I actually do have a response to the research question. The World Blind Union has members around the world, member organizations around the world that do various types of research that are connected to different types of research. And so, you know, there's about 190 countries or more that are represented within the World Blind Union itself. So, you know, we do get very much connected into the research components. And I would recommend that you have a conversation with Mr. Workman, because he does have a lot of connections. So I think that that's very important. And I think from the piece around entrepreneurship, I think I go back to my previous statement that this is not a blindness or disability issue. This is a human issue. And the world needs to get on board and make the world better for everybody. And we need to start looking at it from a global perspective and not just a population of 20%.
Thank you very much. And back to you, Linda.
Thank you. So I think from an RNIB perspective, for us, it's basically advocacy influencing. So we use our influence to elevate the voice of the underrepresented in Africa and the developing countries. But I also wanted to touch on the point that you make, or the question that you made in regards to sort of like ensuring that we can bring entrepreneurship into that space. I think I spoke about context before, and it's basically around allowing grassroots innovation. So that shout out to the technology companies here in regards to the statement that was made by that student is basically, how do we use the grassroots people who understand the problem on the ground to do the innovation? Yes, AI is great and all of that, but let's bring AI, but how do they innovate in the space? And we share that knowledge for them to innovate and use their context to do that innovation. So I think those are the places that we can sort of like influence and use our voice to sort of like represent the underrepresented. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think the panelists have really spoke well, particularly around global innovation, collaboration. Key points, I think technology alone would not solve the problem, be it low-tech or high-tech. But for example, I saw one of the work, a few of my colleagues, for example, were doing social behavioral changes, doing around inclusive design, doing things offline and still using those innovation to kind of bring change around social behavioral. Number two that I probably see here is around adaptation. We need to think around how do we adapt, think global, but still act local. The third point is definitely we need to think more around people in the global south if we really want the change to happen. Some issues are not just specific to people who are visually impaired, but also we need to see it more from a systemic issue. And we then need to think more how we want to work around that. The fourth point is around collaboration. I think collaboration is very, very important. We need to create platform for us to exchange knowledge. And we have to create those platforms as well for innovation. If you agree with me, I think one key point we all need to keep at the back of our mind is that inclusion is possible. Technology makes things possible for people who are visually impaired and other disability. But if we need to get to that future that we all need to do, then we all need to come together and think about the inclusive futures. So thank you very much, and we can make it better next time. Thank you.